Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
When two innocent 9-year-old girls were sexually assaulted and murdered in a park in Brighton, police were certain that they'd found the culprit. But unbelievably, the depraved killer walked free after being cleared of all charges. Unfortunately, because of this, that evil predator would strike again. This is a story of a man who evaded justice for over 30 years, but his crimes eventually caught up with him. This is the case of Russell Bishop. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one that you guys have asked for time and time again. So hopefully, even if you know the case of the Babes in the Wood, you will still feel that at the end of this, you know a little bit more. That's hopefully what I will leave you with. And it is, again, just one of those ultimately horrific cases because it involves children. And even though every single murder and loss to this world is incalculably painful, and in these cases, avoidable if these human predators didn't exist, the truth is that child murder is always more difficult to process. And these cases that I cover are always ones that stay with me because they involve the loss of children. So let's talk about Nicola and Karen, the victims in this case. So on the 22nd of February 1976, Susan and Barry Fellows had their daughter, Nicola. Just a few months later, on December the 21st, 1976, Karen Hadaway was born to her parents, Michelle and Lee. Karen Hadaway and Nicola Fellows then grew up to be best friends. So the children meet young and they solidify a really close relationship. They attended different schools, so it turns out the reason that they really connected is because they lived on the same street on the Moolscombe estate in Brighton. And I think we can all look back to those lovely days where you would literally have a kid of the same age or thereabouts living on the same street as you, and you would invariably end up playing together. The truth is, most of us can recall those days where we just go knock on the door of a kid who looked kind of familiar to us because they lived locally, but we didn't really know. But arguably, because they were the same height as you, you just thought, I'll give it a go. This person could be my new best mate. I remember Colette Linton doing that to me when I was 7. And essentially, she walked past my window at my house, knocked on the door, was like, do you want to play? And she became a best mate immediately. There is something so beautiful and innocent and creative and ingenious as well about relationships when you are a child. And I know that every single one of you will be able to recollect a similar incident where you just become tight-knit to somebody because they live locally to you. And that's exactly what we are describing where Nicola and Karen are concerned. And the parents of these two said that they genuinely were, from the get-go, joined at the hip. Nicola was said to be really friendly, really outgoing. She was the more, shall we say, extrovert of the two. And Karen's mum said that even though she could be cheeky, Karen always knew right from wrong. She was a really sensible and sensitive girl. In 1986, which is the year that we're talking about at this moment in time, they were both just 9 years old. So they were kids who were becoming more savvy about the world. Of course they were. They understood the dangers to some degree, but they were still children. They're at that age where they're still very much innocent of the world around them. But as I said, as they're making their way towards the older age group at primary school, they're also connecting the dots that the world isn't always the safest place to be, and the parents are at that point where they're informing their children of being careful around strangers, for example. So certainly, whilst there is a naivety within their innocence, of course, that's what we expect for these nine-year-old kids, they also are aware that there are people in the world around them that can be problematic, and the parents have reinforced that so that when they're out, they understand the kind of people they should be spending their time with. We get to the late afternoon of October the 5th, 1986. Karen comes home from school as normal. Then she goes to a sweet shop. Then she comes back again, just briefly, and then she leaves the house again. And that is just so resonant of being a kid in a safe environment. Just seeing the world as your playground, those habits of the excitement of going and getting your sweets, and then just going out to play. She was wearing a school uniform at the time, but she had changed into her pink trainers. So clearly was thinking about being able to have some fun and not scuff her school shoes. Her mum, Michelle, had told her not to be out long because she put her tea in the oven. And that's so common for us, isn't it? Just go and enjoy yourself, but be back at home for the meal around the table. Karen reassured her at this point that she wouldn't be late. And that's the last conversation Michelle would ever have with her daughter. And I think they're the things that haunt most of us, aren't they? That there's this extraordinary ordinariness in that last moment. That the last words that they ever speak to each other are just about a meal and making sure that she doesn't get in late. No one could for even a millisecond imagine that that would define the last conversation that these two would have. Because all the words that we'd speak to each other, if we truly believed that we were never going to see that individual that we adore so much, it would take a lifetime to have that conversation, because there would be so many things that you'd want to share. But that's how it ends. That's the last conversation that Michelle has with her daughter. Make sure you're home for your meal. At this point, Karen and her little sister Lindsay had actually gone over to Nicola's house and they were just playing outside. Nicola's mum remembers looking out the window and seeing them all playing together. They were playing with a roller boot at around 5 p.m. And then Michelle came round to collect Lindsay because obviously she wants them home for tea, but Karen isn't there. And then Lindsay tells her that Karen and Nicola have basically run down the road. At this point, obviously they're a little bit concerned because they want to know where the kids are. But Karen still hasn't returned home by 5:20. And now they're really starting to worry about the girls and they're worried about where their daughters have disappeared. And when they don't return by the evening, clearly now they are incredibly anxious. First of all, both of the girls were said to be scared of the dark. So they're not going to be out when they are actually afraid of being out in the dark. And also, they had habits. Back in the time we're talking about, we didn't have Netflix. Sure, a lot of you remember those days where you just genuinely had a few channels. And because you have a few channels, you used to have relationships with particular programs because there wasn't a lot of choice. So you'd form alliances and allegiances with particular programs and you'd look forward to them. And they had this particular connection with Top of the Pops and EastEnders. For those of you who don't know what Top of the Pops was, maybe in another country, it was a pop program where new releases would be put out there and artists would come and perform in the studio and your best pop groups would be present and you'd watch it and be just enchanted because you didn't really have that kind of programming for teenagers particularly and young people. And this was something that was really, really revered in the UK. We absolutely loved Top of the Pops. And as a kid, you did look forward to it. So the fact that they hadn't come back for their favourite programmes, EastEnders is a soap, by the way, if you're wondering what that is. It's a very, very long-running soap in the UK. So again, the dad is saying they wouldn't miss this by choice. So these little fractures in the ordinary foundations are starting to scare the family, because this is totally out of character for their behaviour and they're doing things that would impact on genuinely the enjoyment that they have on a weekly level, which is to sit down and watch those shows. Because bear in mind, you couldn't do what you do today, which is if you miss it, you just go and watch it by pressing a button that takes you to the programme that's now available on a digital format. You didn't have that, did you? You had to ultimately have recorded it on a video recorder, which very few people could afford at the time, or you missed it. So the family is deeply concerned. They start searching for the girls and there are quite a lot of people who've seen them in the local area. So witnesses had seen them at the park. The park keeper themselves had seen the girls playing in a tree near the park around 5:15 p.m. Also, a witness had seen them unwrapping some chips around 6:15 p.m. One teenage boy had actually seen them near the shops on Lewes Road. That was around 6:30 p.m. And they said that they'd actually said to the girls, listen, you need to go home, because they knew that the parents would be worried. So it gives you an idea of a community of people who knew each other and cared for each other. There's a closeness about those kind of relationships where somebody feels confident enough to tell kids, you need to get back for your tea. But apparently they didn't listen. And he heard one of the girls say,
brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Come on, let's go over to the park. Which is completely typical of a kid, isn't it? I don't want to go home for my tea. I've snaffled some chips. By the way, if you don't live in the UK, you probably don't know about our obsession with Chippies, which is a fish and chip shop. But it is quite traditional in the UK that we have bags of chips. These days, I believe cheesy chips are also popular. But it's kind of part of our fabric in the UK that it's a very normal experience for kids to go and buy themselves a bag of chips. But you can imagine that it's been a bit mischievous because they're meant to be going home for the food, but they've obviously sustained themselves at this point and they're now ready to go and play on the park. And yeah, every parent hates it when their kids do that. But it's just such a normal scenario, isn't it? You're just having fun. You don't want the fun to end. You'll deal with the issues with facing your mum later on. Hey, who knows? Maybe you'll be able to fit your tea in at the same time as eating those chips. But they have little or no idea at this moment in time when they're doing these just completely normal, typical, innocent things that kids do, that this is going to be the last evening, the last bag of chips, the last telling off from somebody saying they should get home, because everything's going to end for them shortly. Another witness saw the girls go into the wild park between 6:30 and 6:40 p.m. And the parents were quite surprised, particularly the mums, because they said, you know, this wasn't something they were allowed to do. They weren't allowed to go into the park by themselves. But again, I can look back at being a kid and remember telling my mum that I was going to go around to my friends around the corner and then going up to the woods. I was not allowed in those woods. But at the end of the day, because I wasn't allowed in those woods, I really wanted to go in those woods. And it's ludicrous. There was literally nothing to do. And actually, on reflection, it was pretty scary. But there was something about the allure of going on an adventure to a place where I had been told I was not allowed to be present. This is so normal. And that's when I was a young kid. And I think everyone listening to this will relate to things that we did when we were children that our parents were completely unaware of. But if somebody had told your parents where they'd seen you, they would be surprised, because as far as they're concerned, you're a good little boy or girl. And the consequence of that is, ultimately, they believe that you are abiding by their rules and regulations, even when they're not present. We all know we ignore our parents' rules and regulations the minute that they're not present. But they feel stunned that this atypical behaviour has been brought to them. And now they really do have some grave concerns, because they've gone places that they wouldn't wish for their children to go. Now, as they're searching, and there's many people now searching for these girls because this is completely out of character, a blue sweatshirt is discovered. It was a blue sweatshirt with the word Pinto on it. It was found near a footpath, which was near the train station. And one of the things that we'd noted straight away was, first of all, it was inside out. So that makes it seem as if somebody had taken it off and then just discarded it on the floor. The ground was actually wet at the time, but when they picked the sweatshirt up, it was dry. So that indicates that it hadn't been on the floor very long at all. It hadn't been there for a significant amount of time. So it happened recently. Now, the girls aren't found that evening, so it's incomprehensible for the families at this moment in time. They're dealing with the trauma of the girls not returning. They're dealing with the absolute horror that something likely bad has happened to the kids. They've had to deal with the agony of those endless hours where they literally have no answers, but they'll have that creeping sense of something sinister having played out. But also as a parent, you're going to have hope. You're going to think that some kind of miracle will occur and your children will walk in and you'll just be able to be really angry with them and tell them how their actions have led to you feeling so broken in that moment, and you'll be able to ground them and then they'll learn. And these are the things that will be going through your mind. But I genuinely believe ultimately they will have been fearing the worst. The next morning, which is October the 10th, a search team continues to look for the missing girls. There's police officers, there's neighbours, there's people who directly know the girls. And devastatingly, that afternoon, the girls are found. The bodies of the little girls, at least. They're found in thick undergrowth in a makeshift den in the Wild Park. And it was two 18-year-olds who actually found their bodies. And both of the girls, as soon as the investigators came to the scene, they noted that it looked like they'd been strangled. And it turned out when they did some further investigation on the bodies and the pathologist was able to indicate what had happened, the girls had also been sexually assaulted. So they died in a truly terrifying way. And bear in mind, these girls were 9 years of age. And one of those girls would no doubt have witnessed their friend being murdered. And knowing what's coming, and ultimately the trauma of witnessing somebody that you love deeply, because those girls loved each other, and having to bear witness not only to their demise in the most calculating, cold and cruel of ways, to know that that's going to happen to you too, I cannot even begin to envisage the absolute horror, the psychological devastation that either of those children endured as they witnessed that, knowing they were next. Now, it doesn't take long for Russell Bishop to become a person of interest as far as the police are concerned in relation to the girls' murders. Russell Bishop was quite an odd individual. So he grew up in Brighton on the south coast in the UK. It's a gorgeous area of the world. He was the youngest of Sylvia and Roy Bishop's 5 sons, so a very busy household. And Mrs. Bishop, his mother, she was actually described in court as being a domineering matriarch. She was actually an incredibly successful international dog trainer. She also wrote a dog training manual. So she was well respected in that community, but quite a dominant force, so to speak. And psychologically, what can occur in relationships where you have a parent who's very domineering is that there can at times be a need for you to feel a level of control elsewhere in your life, and to exert control in situations and circumstances where you have the power. Understandably, as a young boy growing up, you're not necessarily going to want to feel a level of demasculation because you have a mother who is archetypally very, very dominant. That said, clearly there's no excuse to act in an abusive way towards anybody else. But I'm saying, if you have fractures in your foundation, shall we say on a genetic level, there's a predisposition for you to maybe have some malevolence within you. Anything that's going to take away your power and control is going to really compromise the way that you feel your life should be, because you're going to have this desire to be controlling. And therefore you might seek other opportunities and avenues to be an individual with power. Also, it's said that she very much favoured him. So again, that's a bit of a problem, because we don't want a parent to have particular favourites, because it means that they're going to be seen and treated in a way that others can see raises them up, whilst the others are not given the same kind of care and attention. And that can mean for the child who's being put on that pedestal that they have more of a superior view about themselves, because a primary caregiver seems to suggest that they are more important. Now, as a child, Bishop did have some problems. So he struggled with dyslexia. He struggled with reading. He struggled with writing. He struggled with problem solving. So he did have some issues, and educationally, I imagine that would have been quite problematic for him. He was also quite short, so he was 5'5" at the time of the murders, and he weighed just over 10 stone. But he was actually said to be relatively charming, also had like a moustache, and I guess that to younger girls, he might not have felt as intimidating because of his height and because of the way that he looked, and also because he was quite a charming individual. And we have to remember that if you're a charming person, you're going to be able to manipulate people more easily. And that in itself is deeply problematic if you have, shall we say, predatory values within your nature, because you're going to use that charm to get what you want. He lived in the Hollingdean area of Brighton. He worked as a roofer. And he was also a criminal, because early on, criminality plays out. He's obsessed with cars, gets involved in car crime and petty crimes per se. And if we think about very violent offenders, often in their background, we will see this graduating from petty crimes to more serious offences. He lived with his partner at the time of the murders. She's called Jenny Johnson. They had this little boy, an infant son called Victor, and lived in Stevens Road, Brighton. But he was also, at the same time, carrying on a relationship with a 16-year-old girl called Marion Stevenson. Apparently, Marion was absolutely besotted by him. And because of the age difference, and because she is basically a child, 16, you're basically still a child, he would have felt like such a grown-up, mature individual to be around. But actually, it's highly inappropriate to be seeing a girl of that age whilst you're in a relationship with a child, with a woman that you're actually meant to be committed to. And on top of this, you're going to have more power in the relationship because you are older and you're more equipped to deal with these circumstances than a kid of 16. So he would have been able to manipulate her and charm her and have power over her. Apparently, in the spare time as well, Bishop and Jenny Johnson were said to be really keen CB radio users. That is going to take some of you back to the 80s and 90s, isn't it? CB radio, where people used to connect with other individuals across the country using these code names. In this case, they went under the handles Silver Bullet and Panda Bear to communicate, but you could kind of chat with people all over the country. These days, obviously, we've got mobile phones, but back then, it was pretty cutting edge having a CB radio. But this is what they do in their spare time. And the other ways he spent his time was, well, basically he was motoring mad, so he'd spray paint cars in his spare time, but also he played football in the park, he'd go night fishing, and he was said to be quite into smoking cannabis, so he did take certain drugs, shall we say. Also, interesting piece of trivia about Bishop, he was actually rounded up by the police investigating the IRA Grand Hotel bombing in 1984, but he was discounted as a serious suspect quite early on. But clearly that demonstrates that he's on the police radar, and the police think he is potentially capable of doing something like carrying out a bombing. And that speaks to me of the danger that they believe that this man posed to society. The fact that he was even rounded up as a potential suspect, it sparks that sense, within my mind at least, that they genuinely were waiting for him to do something really enormous. And there was something about his personality and characteristics that spoke of his potential that really made them concerned about his future intentions. He had had previous issues with the police. He'd been fined for petty theft. And it's also worth noting that even though his father got cleared of this initially, he'd been arrested in relation to the rape and murder of Margaret Frame in 1978. In fact, when people were searching for the girls, his father had actually said to Bishop, "Don't go out and search for the girls. You could implicate yourself in the crime." So he was advising his son to stay away from the crime situation and scene on the basis that he himself had found himself being noted by the police as a potential suspect in this horrific rape and murder of this girl. So it's strange that there was suspicion on the father and now there's suspicion on the son. Arguably, one could say, well, that could be because the police are really biased and have decided that a man who was innocent of the murder of Margaret Frame was somebody that they believed was still guilty, and like father, like son. Or it could be that the police genuinely did believe that he was the culpable party and that his son was, shall we say, fitting a very similar pattern to what they'd seen in the father. Bishop was actually known as well to the families of both girls, so he actually played football with Nicola's father, Barry. So he played football with him on a Sunday. And it's chilling to imagine that your child's murderer could be somebody that you spend time with regularly. He'd even, as I said, taken part in searching for the girls. So this is somebody who wants to be seen to be a good public individual, a good member of our community, searching for these missing girls, that now the police think potentially he's been involved with killing. And also, as noted, that the families know him because he's spent time around both the girls and the parents. Now, he's known as well at this point, by the way, for being highly inappropriate around young girls. So in the local area, he was said to be somebody who would lust after girls doing handstands in the park, saying things like, wait until she's 13 or 14. So we're talking about really young kids. The fact that they're doing handstands in the park means, firstly, they really are unaware about how often that leaves them looking exposed and vulnerable, because we all know what it was like to be a kid wearing a dress and then you stand on your head and your dress is around your head and your knickers are exposed, and often you're not even wearing a vest, so everything's exposed, but you're a kid and you're innocent and you're naive and you don't think that there are perverts witnessing what you're doing and using that to gratify themselves. In this case, that seems to be what Bishop was doing, but the very fact that he then suggests that he's got to wait till they are 13 or 14. Now, I do appreciate in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s, people were not taking as seriously as they should have inappropriate.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Relationships between adults and kids. So 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds were often seen as fair game by men of 20, 21, 22. And this is something that is shameful, but it definitely happened. So the very fact that he thought that 13 or 14-year-olds were acceptable to have a relationship with, like, you know, 11, 9, 10, that's a little bit too young. With 13, 14, totally acceptable, totally okay, totally appropriate. That demonstrates the predator that we're talking about right now, because he clearly saw them as fair game. We get to October the 31st, 1986. At this point, the police call at Russell's house because that sweatshirt has been something they want to identify. They want to know, is this sweatshirt that's been found and it was looking like somebody discarded it the night that the girls were killed, was it his? Jennifer, his partner, answers the door, and when she's shown the Pinto sweatshirt, she said, you've bought Russell's top back. She also said that Russell had got red staining on the sleeves, and that would basically be how they could identify whether it was his. Apparently it was a stain that he tried to get out again and again, but it hadn't worked, hadn't washed out. Apparently he'd done it when he was working on one of the cars. So the sweatshirt that the police found, first of all, it has that red stain that she said it would. She also goes ahead and signs a witness statement that says, yes, this sweatshirt belongs to Bishop. So now the police feel that this identifies that Russell Bishop was in the area at the time that the girls would have been murdered. So they arrest him. He'd been seen in the same area as the girls prior to the murder. Witnesses had testified to that. And whilst he was actually helping to search for the girls, he was doing that with his dog Misty. Russell said a really strange thing to a police officer. He said, if I found the girls and if they were done in, I'd get the blame. I'd get nicked. Bear in mind, at the point that he's having that conversation with the police officer, everyone in the local area thinks the girls are just missing. They don't think they're dead. Everyone's assuming that they're alive at this moment. And so him having that conversation is really odd. For the vast majority of us, you can't imagine going up to a police officer when a search for some kids who are missing is taking place and basically suggesting that, hey, if they turn up dead, everyone's gonna think I did it. First of all, just going to throw it out there, kind of puts a bit of a spotlight on you, doesn't it? From out of nowhere, this individual just comes up to an officer of the law and basically goes, hey, I'm the kind of person that they'd be looking for in this kind of crime if there was a crime that had happened, which we don't know has happened because we don't actually know a crime's happened right now. But I'm just saying that if a crime had happened, I would probably be the person who would get implicated in that crime. Most probably because I'm now speaking to an officer of the law, implicating myself in a crime that we don't even know has happened yet, but that will be found out to have happened because, I don't know, I did it. Clearly, Russell Bishop was not at the front of the queue where common sense was concerned. So the police were concerned about that comment, number one, but also it's the way that he's acting when the girls have been discovered. So he's at the crime scene. Now we all know particular types of offenders, they really like to be forensically involved, don't they? They like to be seen where the crimes happen because it titillates them, it excites them. And also they have this weird idea that if they are present there and they act shocked or stunned or surprised, that essentially people are going to be like, well, they definitely didn't do it because they looked surprised that this awful thing had happened, or they looked sad that this awful thing had happened. But the problem is, in these situations, the behaviour is often so off that it literally implicates the person as opposed to making them look innocent. So there is just something about the way that he's loitering, about the way that he's acting during that period that again alerts the investigator's attention. And another thing that is problematic for Russell Bishop is that he'd been seen wearing a light blue top on the day of the murders. So again, the fact that people had seen him wearing this light blue top, and then in the area where the girls are found, there is a light blue top that we now know was his, that demonstrates that they're going to be making these links very easily, because he's essentially creating a breadcrumb trail back to him. Now, Bishop didn't deny that he'd seen the girls. He said, yeah, I saw both of the girls around 5 p.m. that evening. And he even went on to say that he saw them at the entrance of Wild Park. He said that he saw that they were talking to the park keeper. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I walk down a street on a daily basis. I notice very little. Unless there is something completely out of the ordinary. If it's an extraordinary scenario unfolding in front of my eyes, you bet your bottom dollar I'm going to be like stopped watching it. But that's very unusual that those moments occur. For the most part, I don't notice very much at all. The last thing I'm probably going to be doing is thinking, oh, what are those two girls doing and who are they speaking to? Even if I recognise them, the fleeting experience of passing somebody in the street, it doesn't catch your attention to a huge degree. But apparently Bishop is noticing exactly what the girls are doing and where they're going. And that speaks to me of somebody who's essentially following them. The reason that he knows that they're talking to the park keeper and that the entrance of Wild Park is likely because he's stalking them. He says that after he's noticed this conversation taking place, he then goes and buys some cannabis from his dealer, says this happens about 5:40 p.m. and then he returns back home around 6:30 p.m. He even goes on and adds that he had an insurance man and woman come into his house and they were due at 6:30. Now, the police want to quantify that this is true. So they go and speak to Bishop's dealer, and Bishop's dealer says, yeah, yeah, Russell Bishop is definitely a regular customer of mine, but I don't recall him visiting the day of the murders. Then they look at the insurance alibi, that these insurance agents had come round to his house, so obviously it couldn't be him. And they said, well, we can't corroborate that because we have a policy with that particular family. Yeah, we called round at 4:30 p.m. that day, but no one answered the door. So essentially they posted a sorry we missed you card through the letterbox, so it doesn't stack up. Neither of his potential alibis are playing out in reality. Also, Russell said that when the bodies were actually found, he was present. So he's now putting himself right at the centre of this. And bear in mind, we've just heard that when the girls are potentially being murdered, he's saying that he's got these solid alibis that haven't actually been real. They haven't played out in reality. And now he's recollecting that he actually was present when the bodies were found. He said that he'd gone over to them and he'd even gone so far as to try to find a pulse. He even described their position, said that Karen's head was resting on Nicola's lap, also said that there was bloody foam around Nicola's mouth. But the people who found the bodies first, they were amazing, to be honest. And they disputed that could ever have happened because they refused to let anybody come closer than 15 feet. And I guess the reason that they prevented people coming over is because, firstly, that could contaminate evidence. I'm not saying that they were forensically sophisticated enough to understand that. They probably had an inkling that they should keep the crime scene free of anybody coming over because that could cause a problem for the individual coming over because of the fact that information from their bodies could be passed on to the child's body. But also, I think the other thing is just out of respect. These were two little nine-year-old kids who've been found dead. They don't want people just coming and ogling at their bodies. It's a respect thing. But he's tried to suggest that he's come over, he's had contact with the bodies. So he's obviously trying to think, like, how would I acknowledge why my forensic details maybe been passed on to the bodies of the kids? All right, well, I can go over, touch them. That would explain if there was any contamination between me and them. The other thing is, he's giving very specific details. So describing the actual way that the kids lay, only somebody who'd been very close to that scene would be able to describe that. And also the blood around Nicola's mouth, I mean, you'd have to be really up close and personal. He wouldn't have been able to know those details at a distance of 15 feet. And a detective actually commented that he had probably said that to make sure that if there were any fingerprints on the girls' bodies, that would account for this possibility. But you've got to be really Machiavellian, really manipulative, haven't you, to actually try to create a scenario where you have identified why something from your body would be on theirs. So this is somebody who definitely would want to get away with a crime. This isn't somebody who's going to take responsibility and accountability. At no point would those actions suggest that that were the case. Now we get to November the 1st, 1986. This is when Jennifer Johnson Bishop's partner goes to the police station. And surprise, surprise, retracts her statement. So bear in mind, she's told the police, yeah, that's definitely Russell's top because it's got the red stain on the sleeve, he's washed it lots of time, came from a car, etc. So she's given a backstory to this particular item of clothing. And the police wouldn't have a clue how that stain on the sleeve would have been there unless she'd informed them of what that stain was from. They wouldn't have ever connected that. So it's clearly his, but now apparently it isn't. Apparently it doesn't belong to Russell Bishop, and she also said, I'm not gonna go to court. So this is a big problem, because clearly there was an implication by her admitting that Russell Bishop's top was the one that they'd found, and now she's removed that. Now, after Bishop was arrested and released on bail, he had the audacity to go over to the fellow's house to actually tell them that he hadn't murdered their daughter. And Barry actually said that one of the things that was really striking about the way that he acted was that Russell didn't seem to care about how the family were doing at all. Didn't even ask if they were okay. So their daughter's just been murdered. Yes, okay, he has been arrested, and he's now trying to protest his innocence. But if you were to go around to somebody's house to see the parents of a child that you've been accused of murdering, and you're going to do it because you want them to see that you're innocent, the thing that you're going to be concerned about most is how they feel. You're going to be saying to them, I understand that you would likely feel absolute hate towards me because you think that I am a suspect, but I am promising you I am not a suspect. I cannot believe what's happened to you. I cannot believe what's happened to your daughter. Tell me how you're doing. Let me explain why they are wrong about me, and how do I reach you in your pain when I'm under this shadow of suspicion? You're not going to be just going around to go, listen, I didn't do it. I'm completely innocent. Everyone's got it wrong. And by the way, I don't actually care about how you feel. Because again, it's going to really alert the family and to the authorities, because they're going to have that conversation with the police, that there is something unusual about your behaviour. We get to December the 3rd, 1986. At this point, Russell is arrested again, and it's at this point that he's actually formally charged with murder. Understandably, his partner is really unhappy that he's been charged with murder, and Jennifer is in a situation, I think, that would be quite difficult. First of all, you don't want to believe that your partner is a child sexual predator and murderer. No one in the history of partners wants that for a reality in their life. So there will be a part of her that wants to protect him, a part of her that wants to believe him, a part of her that is suspicious of him, a part of her that's likely scared of him. But what she does, in my opinion, is absolutely inexcusable. Because on January the 2nd, 1987, she signs a statement basically claiming that she'd never seen Russell wear a Pinto sweatshirt. The police know that she's lying, but arguably she's put that down in black and white. And she even says that the police had come round and taken lots of his clothing. So now she's implicating the police are the ones who have potentially tried to fit Bishop up. And she also said that she hadn't been shown the statements that she'd given and she didn't even know what they said. So she's basically created this nightmare situation where the police are now being accused of fabricating and lying about her statements and also about the connection with Russell, Bishop, and this top. We get to November 1987. This is when the trial is playing out, and Jennifer actually gives evidence on the 20th of November, and she's treated as a hostile witness. So a hostile witness in the UK is somebody who basically is called to court and then refuses to testify in support of the people who called them. In this case, the prosecution. And that's a big problem because the jury are going to hear the witness who is meant to be strongly in support, in this case of the prosecution, deny that support. And that's deeply devastating for this case in particular. So during this period, she insists she never recognised the Pinto sweatshirt. She said that I actually told the police that it wasn't Russell's. And bear in mind, the prosecution, they'd actually been depending on Jennifer's testimony. But she said, I didn't write the statement that they've got. She even said that the initials on some of the documents had been forged. So it's catastrophic for the prosecution. There's no other way of describing that. The reality is she's in a situation where the power has been placed in her court to some degree. They've asked her these questions, and as opposed to her confirming what they needed to confirm, she's not just denied it, she's now cast doubt and suspicion on the police investigators. The jury are listening to that and thinking, my God, have they tried to fit Russell Bishop up? And that's really problematic for the whole case per se. Because if she's lying about this, then the chances are that she's having an impact on a trial of a child murderer that might get off because of her willingness to lie. But the jury aren't going to be doing a character assassination of her at this moment in time. She's just somebody who's come in and said, listen, this is all lies. And because they haven't got the historical understanding about who Russell Bishop is, because they don't know that he's the weirdo saying that he wants to have relationships with girls of 13 and 14 and watching kids doing handstands, because the police may indeed have made all of this.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
But to basically get an innocent man sent down, it's going to make them think, is there reasonable doubt? And that's blindsiding when you think that the consequence of that could be that a man who is so darkly malevolent and dangerous could essentially be found not guilty on this testimony. And that's exactly what happens. On December the 10th, 1987, Russell Bishop is cleared of the murder charges. Cleared. And what came to light later down the line, which is absolutely horrific, is that during this period of time, he'd actually got to know an 11-year-old. This was in 1985. During his period, when he's in prison awaiting his trial, he's grooming that little girl for sex in a series of letters. So apparently in his childish handwriting, he peppered love letters with hearts and kisses, all the whilst bragging about his sexual prowess, telling the girl he was a man, not a boy. Bear in mind, that's whilst he is waiting trial. He's literally grooming an 11-year-old little girl for sex. So we are dealing with a predator of the highest level, but also someone who literally takes no responsibility and accountability, hasn't changed his behaviour. He doesn't think he's done anything wrong. He wouldn't have been communicating with this kid whilst he was awaiting trial for the double murder of two little girls who were literally just a couple of years younger than the child that he's writing to. And the fact that he says, I'm a man, not a boy. So he knows ultimately he's a grown up, and yet he's having this sexual communication with a little girl. Now, in addition to the retraction of the crucial statement that I've just talked about from Bishop's girlfriend, it's also worth noting that there were some really big mistakes made in the investigation that definitely contributed to Russell Bishop not being convicted. So a rookie error, the girl's body's temperature wasn't taken when they discovered the bodies. Now that's horrific, because you need a reliable time of death ideally, because that's how you figure out who had access to those kids at that time, whose alibi makes sense, and so on and so forth. But as a result, the alibi that Bishop provided, it couldn't be disputed. Also, the marks that were left on the girls' necks from being strangled, they didn't measure them. So that means they were unable to be compared to potential suspects. Also, and this is just unbelievable, there was blood that had been found in Karen's underwear. They never analysed it. They never analysed the blood. So a massive amount of mistakes, a catalogue of failings, I would say. And that is absolutely unforgivable, because this means that Russell Bishop, a dangerous child molesting predator, was literally free to do as he pleased. And the problem with that is when a violent, murdering, sexual predator is allowed back on our streets, it's not going to change the behaviour, is it? Particularly if there are literally no consequences whatsoever. If you get away with murder, if you don't have to fear the police because they've made so many mistakes, then why would you change your actions in the future? If anything, it emboldens you to do more. It gives you the confidence to go ahead and potentially kill again. And when you think about the mindset of somebody like Bishop, I think this demonstrates just how arrogant and self-interested and egotistical he was. Because when he's released, after he's been found not guilty in inverted commas, he went on to complain that he'd contemplated suicide because in his local community, he was treated with suspicion and accusations, and it made him mentally unwell. I mean, I don't know about you guys. If I suspected that an individual who may have got off on some kind of technicalities and also the testimony of his partner, and essentially that had led to him being released, even though at the end of the day, I'd found out that he'd literally been in close proximity to the bodies of the girls, touched the girls, knew things that he shouldn't know about the crime scene itself, was also in my local area known to be a little bit of a pervert in the way that he spoke about little girls and watched little girls in the park doing handstands. And then, I don't know, he's living next door to me. I might be a little bit hostile, shall we say, a little bit on the hostile side, a little bit on the, if you so much as look at one of my children, you are going to lose a part of your body. You're going to lose maybe a few parts of your body. Just putting it out there. I know threats of violence and vigilante behaviour is not acceptable. I'm just saying that as a mother or a father, you can't help but have a feeling of rage when you even contemplate that somebody could wish to do anything bad to your kids. So to know that a child sexual predator, potentially, or a child murderer, potentially, is in your locality, is going to lead to things like aspersions being cast at them and negativity being given to them. Because, you know, if the cap fits, and there's no smoke without fire. And what is truly horrific is, bear in mind, this man knows what he's done. And yet, his main primary concern is that, in spite of him knowing that he's guilty, the people around him, as far as he's concerned, should accept that he's innocent. And even though by right, he should be sent on a gondola of flames to hell, the truth is that he feels that he deserves sympathy. He deserves empathy. And more than that, he's demanding it to some degree, meaning that he believes that even though he has done these horrible things, because the courts haven't validated it, no one has a right to accuse or abuse him, all the while knowing exactly what he's done, knowing exactly what he's guilty of. We get to February the 4th, 1990, and this is why what his girlfriend did in court and the failures in the case are so utterly devastating and have ramifications that are too terrible to even imagine. Because on February the 4th, 1990, a seven-year-old little girl, a seven-year-old child, was literally abducted off the street while she's roller skating. She's put in the boot of a car. How terrifying, how horrifying for this little kid who minutes earlier has just been innocently playing, enjoying her childhood, free from fear. And all of a sudden she's bundled into the boot of this unfamiliar car, petrified. She's driven to Devil's Dyke in Brighton. It's a woodland area in Brighton. This is where she's undressed, she's horrifically sexually assaulted, and she is strangled. She said that the last thing that she remembered was trying to say, "I can't breathe." When her attacker left her, they left her for dead. They assumed she'd absolutely no chance of surviving. But she came round. Thank God that she went unconscious. Thank God that she seemed to have died, because otherwise, she certainly would have been finished off by her attacker. When she came around, she was freezing. She was naked. She was bleeding. She was 7 years of age. I can't even imagine her fear, the profound knowledge of being in an unfamiliar circumstance and situation, not knowing what's happened, not understanding or comprehending why it's happened, the feeling of fear that maybe you've done something wrong, because that's how seven-year-olds feel. What did I do? And she's totally vulnerable. She is a little warrior, because she, in spite of all those things I've just said, miraculously somehow manages to pick herself up and she walks to the road. And my God, divine intervention, because a couple, they'd pulled over for a flask of tea, and they see her and they rescue her. At this point, emergency services are immediately called. And fortunately, this amazing child, because it's hard to remember if you're a parent of older children, what they're like at seven, because obviously our children have always been the children that we've got in that moment. But when you actually take a moment and just reflect back to those days, they're just babies, aren't they? And to imagine this little warrior of a girl has been through all of that, but she's also managed to stain the image of that predator into her conscience, and she's able to identify Russell. She literally picks him out from an identity parade. What an incredible human being. And also they're able to gather fluid from the little girl's clothes. They're able to do some DNA testing, and this matched Russell Bishop's DNA with a certainty of 80 million to one. Bang to rights, Russell. Bang to freaking rights. But I bet he didn't imagine that was going to play out, right? And you know what really worries me about this kind of a predator is we're assuming that this is the only child that he's done that to since his release. I would be very, very surprised if it was, because I'm telling you, a predator with the confidence to literally abduct a child from the street, and then as far as they're concerned, to absolutely snuff out the life of that child after sexually gratifying themselves, this is somebody who is incredibly confident as a perpetrator. I sadly suspect that there is a chance that Russell Bishop could have killed other children. I genuinely do. I just look at the confident nature of his crime and also the fact that we know what he's been responsible of before this. I cannot escape the fear that he's probably taken more lives. On December the 13th, 1990, Russell pleaded not guilty to the abduction and attempted murder of this poor little girl. Fortunately, because I don't know, the jury have ears and eyes. They do actually say that he's guilty, he's convicted of attempted murder, kidnap and indecent assault. And he was actually sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 14 years. So they obviously took it very, very seriously, those actions. And with respect, that's because they knew they were dealing with a child murderer. Simple as that. He might not have physically killed that kid, but he wanted to. And that, in my mind, is exactly the same as actually successfully killing the child. Yes, she gets to live another day. And thank God for that. Thank God that a kid with that nature gets to carry on, because what a warrior she was and how she saved so many other children, in my mind, because she did. We cannot escape the reality that he would have killed again. And that little girl saved other little girls. And the very fact that she does get to survive does not change the fact that he definitely wanted her dead and should be treated that way. Now, there's a change in the law in 2003, and this is, I would say, exciting for people like me, because I want violent perpetrators and child murderers to be tried and sentenced for the crimes that they commit. But up until 2003, there was something called the double jeopardy rule. And the double jeopardy rule meant that you couldn't be tried a second time for the same crime. So essentially, you couldn't keep putting somebody through a trial when they'd been found innocent. And we can all understand that to some degree that makes sense. You don't want somebody constantly having to go through the motions of a really intensely psychologically challenging trial again and again and again. But I don't know, I'm just going to throw it in there. Just going to throw it in that at the end of the day, I do definitely want child murderers tried again and again and again. At the end of the day, this should happen if new evidence is brought to light. But until 2003, it couldn't. However, it changes. At this point, as long as new evidence is discovered that can tie the person to the crime, you can. If you haven't watched my Gary Allen video, that's a serial killer in the UK, go and watch that after you've watched this, because I cover the double jeopardy crime situation in detail. But basically, if new evidence is discovered, you can try the person. Again, it has to be strong evidence. So even though this ruling changed, it didn't give carte blanche for everybody to get retried. It has to be really significant. It has to be new. But if that comes to light, Russell Bishop could legitimately be tried again. We get to the 10th of May, 2016, and at this point, Russell Bishop is arrested again. Now, he's already in prison. He's serving the sentence that we've just covered for the horrific abduction and attempted murder of that little girl. But by this point, evidence from Nicola and Karen's case has been retested, and there've been all these incredible advances in the analysis of DNA, and it warms my heart, it genuinely does, because I know that there are perpetrators and murderers and molesters out there whose time is coming. They may have been walking the streets for many years of freedom, but the truth is their time is getting closer and closer to being brought to justice for these horrific crimes, because we are moving so fast in these forensics and in these analyses that these individuals will eventually find that their day in court is going to happen. So now it's possible to link the Pinto sweatshirt to both of the girls and Russell Bishop. So there were fibres on the Pinto sweatshirt that absolutely matched the clothing from Russell's house. Also, they matched the jumpers that Karen and Nicola were wearing. In addition to this, a skin flake found on Karen's arm was analysed, and it was found to be a 1 in a billion match to Russell. That's right, Russell. 1 in a billion. Read that and weep, sweetheart. So, of course, at this point, finally, the prosecution could apply for Russell to be retried. And on top of that, they could present this new evidence in the case of Karen and Nicola. And you just have to imagine the way that that must have felt, the prosecution knowing that finally this child murderer was going to be brought to justice, or at least they had a very strong case that could ultimately lead to him being sentenced for the murders of Karen and Nicola. I imagine that the prosecution were elated at this point. So, of course, they get Russell Bishop in, they interview him, and at this point, he's asked whether he touched Karen's forearm. And he said, quote, "I didn't touch no one, so I'm innocent. And as I have said, I've got no comment to make." Just gonna throw it out there, Mr. Bishop. Did you just say that you have no comment to make? Yes. I'm innocent, I didn't touch no one's forearm, and I've got no comment to make. I'm just gonna throw it out there that you just made a comment, you absolute loser. I doubt it went like that, but in my head, that is the way it should have played out. So at this point, a new DNA sample of Russell Bishop's is collected, and it confirmed, of course, that it was his DNA linking him to the crimes, even though "I didn't touch no one's arm, I'm completely innocent, I've got no comment to make." Seriously, I know you can't hit people across the face with a cold fish, but at the end of the day, I do think at some time, a big slap with a wet kipper would be an acceptable protocol. So at this point, they then agree that they can retry him for the murders of Karen and Nicola, and absolutely 100% they should. So we get to December 2018. This is when the second trial takes place. And of course, Russell Bishop says, "I'm completely innocent. I didn't do anything wrong," but doesn't go very well, shall we say, in the cross-examination. I mean, cross-examinations can be very difficult and challenging for anybody, but when you are guilty as hell and they have all the evidence that they could ever wish to have in the whole universe, aside from literally having a videotape of the crime playing out, it's not going to go well for you, is it? Particularly when you've got a schooled barrister cross-examining you. Of course, during this, he can't handle it, realises that he's looking guilty, and he gets really angry and then refuses to answer any questions when he realises that his story is falling apart. Isn't going to go well for you as far as the jury is concerned, because I don't know. As a jury member, it's very simple, isn't it? If somebody's innocent, they've got nothing to prove. So they're quite happy to answer questions. Only if you are guilty and you can see the web of lies unravelling, is then that you're going to be difficult. So he's doing himself absolutely no favours whatsoever. Also, new evidence came to light about what happened the afternoon that the girls were murdered. So apparently, Russell Bishop and his then 16-year-old girlfriend, Marion, they'd actually gone round to Nicola's house. So their friend, Dougie Judd, was basically lodging with Nicola's parents, and they'd obviously gone to speak to him there. The girls had apparently been told by the parents that they weren't allowed to speak to Russell Bishop because he had this teenage girlfriend and that he also had this adult girlfriend. So the girls are obviously being warned about him because the parents realise it is quite predatory, but also on a moral level, they don't like the fact that he's coming to their house with his bit on the side, this young girl, and they're educating their daughters.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Not to speak to him because of this. Now, apparently Nicola, who must have been quite feisty because she's only a kid, she told them both to go away when they'd arrived at her house and even called Marion a slag. A slag is a basic terminology that suggests a girl who's promiscuous. So obviously Nicola had quite a spirit about her, shall we say. But this really upset Russell Bishop. That's what they allege. They say that this really affected him. And again, if you are somebody who likes to be in control, if you are somebody with a superior belief system about yourself, maybe some narcissistic tendencies where you genuinely believe that everyone should admire you, and then you have this little girl telling you that you shouldn't be essentially with the girl that you're with because it's morally wrong, but also being negative about that girl to her face, well, that's really going to affect you. You're not going to be happy with that at all. And they believe that this incited real rage, particularly towards Nicola when he was killing them. In court, they also bring up just how manipulative he was. You know, the fact that he pretended to help search for the girls after he'd murdered them. And the barrister said it was a cynical and deliberate attempt to divert attention away from himself. The prosecutor, Brian Altman, said that the science alone is simply so overwhelming as to prove not only that the defendant wore the Pinto shirt, but also that the Pinto was worn by him when he killed those two girls. So he genuinely has been shown to be the predator and murderer that he truly is, and the evidence is just overwhelming and compelling. In Mr. Justice Sweeney's sentencing remarks, once he's found guilty, he actually detailed how, on the day of the murders, Russell had seen Karen and Nicola playing near the Wild Park at 5:15 p.m. and had been in a position to lure them to a secluded area around 6:30. He said that he'd punched Nicola in the face, put his hand over her nose and mouth, and sexually assaulted both girls. But the worst of the sexual assault was directed towards Nicola, and it's believed that this was because she had been rude to Marion earlier on in the day. Also, they said that the sexual assaults of Nicola continued after her death, so he actually abused her corpse. Then he walked home, discarded that Pinto sweatshirt on the way home, which is why it was found. And he also went on to say that during this trial, which is obviously the second trial, you falsely again pretended you were innocent. You have no remorse whatsoever for what you did. It's galling because Russell didn't even attend court for his sentencing. I have said this before and I will say this again. I genuinely think if you have somebody who's just been found guilty of murdering anybody, in fact, if you've been found guilty of any crime whatsoever, you shouldn't have a choice to attend court for the sentencing. It should just be compulsory. I'm sorry, you're saying what? Yeah, I'm not coming to court. Even what? Sorry, you're not what? Yeah, I'm not coming to court for the sentencing. Why do you think that you have a choice? Well, I have human rights, because at the end of the day, if I don't want to go somewhere, what are you going to do? At the end of the day, you can't make me. John, fetch the ropes, the horses. We've got one that we're going to be dragging to court again this week. We are having fun with this new change in the law that Judge Emma Kenny's passed. Honestly, I cannot bear it. You have these individuals who are literally found guilty of the most heinous crimes, and they're like, yeah, I'm not going to go and have my sentencing read out to me in court. I'm not going to sit there whilst the victims' families in this case actually get to read statements that I have to listen to. No, I'm going to control this environment, and I'm just going to sit here and fail to even acknowledge this is playing out. That's what he did. So he gets to not even be there for his sentencing. I also think that if I was the judge in the case where somebody refused to turn up, I would triple their sentence. I'd be like, okay, so let's look at the quotient expectation for the amount of time this person should get. Let me get, oh, that's like, yeah, like 30 years. So times that by 17, add on another 33,000. So I'm gonna, yeah, so I did think I was going to give him this sentence, but now I've decided to give him infinity. In fact, I'm sentencing him right now to life in prison and life in hell. I'm going to do that. There's my hammer. I've done it. Honestly, it's so distressing because they have to take responsibility and accountability or they will never, ever be able to be rehabilitated. It's as simple as that. And if you're not willing to go and hear your sentencing, then you cannot, under any universe, believe that you're deserving of what's happening. And that means that you think that what you've done is acceptable to some degree. When it comes down to the sentence he's given life in prison with a minimum term of 36 years for each murder. So 2054 will be the earliest that he'd be able to be released. He'll be 88 years of age at the time. It's crazy to think that he got that sentence when he was 52 years of age, but he'd actually committed those murders when he was 20. So it's a hell of a long time that he was alive without being indicated and implicated as the murderer for those two little girls. And even though to some degree justice has been served now, we also have to remember that Karen's father, Lee, he died in 1998. So he's never had the satisfaction of knowing that his child's murderer has finally been brought to justice. And that's inexcusable, isn't it? That the initial mess ups in the original trial meant that Lee died not knowing this outcome. The judge also, during his summing up, went on to describe Russell Bishop as a violent and predatory paedophile. Clearly, we know that because of his other offences. And what is really sickening is that Russell Bishop had actually tried to implicate Nicola's father, Barry Fellows, in the murder. Can you imagine that? So he even tried to deflect and project on to an innocent man. Now, of course, Barry was completely innocent and the claims were dismissed by the police, but like anything, they have to be investigated. So Barry, the child's father, dealing with his grief, losing his daughter in the most horrific of ways, had to literally be investigated for the crime. And it caused loads of heartbreak, loads of anguish for an already grieving and devastated parent. And also for all the members of the family who had to witness him being investigated. After he was sentenced, Karen's mother, Michelle, said this. She said that the beautiful girls will be 9 years old forever. She also said they will never grow up and noted that what people like Bishop inflict on families of their victims is a living death. I think that's so apt. Nicola's family called Russell Bishop a monster, saying that he's a predatory paedophile and evil personified. Detective Superintendent Jeff Riley, who was actually given accommodation for leading the investigation, said that Russell was a wicked, arrogant, and massively dishonest individual, and that the case had hung over Morscombe for 30 years. So, yes, this case had caused a shadow over the entire area because people knew that these two girls had been murdered and nobody had been brought to justice. In 2019, Jennifer, so Russell Bishop's partner at the time, admitted that her original statement that the Pinto sweatshirt belonged to Russell was actually factual and that she lied after this, denying that it was his. In March 2020, she went on to say that she'd retracted her statement under duress and that her actions were due to the threat of imminent death or serious violence in the context of a relationship, that she was being coercively abused. And she also commented that Russell Bishop's relatives were a family that he didn't get on the wrong side of. But the judge said that they didn't actually accept that before the offences, Jennifer had been in a coercive relationship. And it was argued that she had lied to protect Russell and also to help in his acquittal. The judge said that the perjury had indeed led to Russell being cleared in 1987 and, quote, the effect of your dishonesty endured for over three decades. So Jennifer was actually charged with perjury, making a false statement, and also for perverting the course of justice. And in May 2021, she was actually sentenced to 6 years in prison. Now, I am 100% behind the fact that she needed to be punished. She absolutely did. She had absolutely no place on this planet trying to protect a child rapist and murderer, even if she was being pressured by his family to do so. You do not do that. You cannot allow yourself to walk this earth with that knowledge, because that person can, and in fact did, go on to do a terrible thing because he was allowed to walk our streets. But I guess we could say a question arises about the 1987 Russell Bishop trial, because understandably she did lie about the sweatshirt that belonged to him. But when you think about when that sweatshirt really did become crucial evidence, that was only really after developments in DNA. That's what actually created this indisputable link between Russell Bishop and the girls. But again, we can't go back in time. But what we can say is, if she hadn't been that hostile witness at the time, there is a possibility that he would have been convicted. And the fact that she went out of her way to lie about things meant that he didn't. And what we know is that a seven-year-old girl suffered horribly at his hands and almost died because he did have his freedom. We get to January the 20th, 2022, and Russell actually died in HMP Frankland, aged 55. He did have bowel cancer and heart disease at the time, and he'd been advised by the NHS to shield due to his ill health because COVID had been around, but he didn't want to take the advice. So he ended up falling ill, got taken to hospital struggling to breathe, and he died in hospital where he tested positive for COVID. So I'm not saying he died of COVID, obviously, he probably died of the bowel cancer and heart disease, but obviously it didn't help getting COVID. After his death, Lorna Heffron, who was Nicola's cousin, she said that the family were really relieved. You know, they were glad they got justice before he died, but they're also bloody glad he's dead and that he'll never, ever be able to hurt anybody else in the future. And she went on to say that the world is a better place without him. Amen. It is definitely a better place without him. I also like the fact that he decided to ignore the advice he was giving, and that's what essentially could have played into him dying, because arguably he's so superior and egocentric that he thinks that he can give himself medical advice over the experts and so on and so forth. That kind of amuses me, because if he just needed to push to the other side, well, he kind of gave it himself. Also, I pray there was a fiery reception waiting for him when he took that final breath. Now, going back to that little 7-year-old warrior, the survivor of that horrific attack by Russell Bishop. Obviously, her name was kept out of the press because she was a little girl, and you want to protect the anonymity of that child because of the fact that you don't want them reminded consistently for the rest of their lives that they were a victim. But after he died, she came forward. She's called Rachel Watts. And she said, "I want people to know the damage he caused." She said that she remembered the attack, even though her family desperately hoped that she wouldn't. She also said that she was conscious whilst Russell Bishop sexually assaulted her, and she said that she hopes to be better one day, because she couldn't see herself living as a prisoner for the rest of her life, which is essentially what she said she'd become. That's what he stole. He didn't just steal those moments. He didn't just traumatize her for a short period of time. He has affected her whole life. It will have affected the relationships that she's had. It will have affected her sense of vulnerability in the world around her. It will have made her question every human being she comes into contact with. That's what he stole. He stole her trust in the world. And she's had to live with that and through that since the attack. And we can only hope and pray that Rachel does find that in the end, she becomes that survivor of trauma where she can thrive fully in this world, and where that bastard doesn't contaminate every waking moment. Because that's what happens to so many of these victims. These perpetrators infect every moment that they should be given peace. I think we're all just very glad he's dead, but I genuinely think that the 20 years that the family didn't have closure to these crimes, it's just unforgivable that they had to manage that. It's something that creates such a void in the world of the families who are affected by these kind of crimes. And it's a void that will never be fully filled, because clearly the lives of their loved ones has been taken, but at least it closes the gap. You have knowledge. This is the person who is guilty. This is the person who's culpable and responsible. And most importantly, this is the person being punished for that crime. Ultimately, if you don't have that, every waking hour, you believe that the perpetrator of that agony in your world could be walking the streets with their freedom intact. Also, I hope that Rachel now breathes easier in her world, knowing that a man who doesn't deserve breath in this world finally no longer has it. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.